Okay, welcome to Rabbeinu B'chai Parshas Kedoshim. Welcome back after the Pesach break. I wanted to start really just with one line in the Rabbeinu B'chai in the very beginning of the Parsha, and then skip to see some more pieces that he has a little bit more at depth, a little bit more at length. But you know, Kedoshim is the Parsha, as Rashi Rashi Rav Gufei Torah Tluyin Ba, that the majority of the principles of Torah are attached to the idea of are in the parasha of Kedoshim. The very idea of Kedoshim Tiyu, of being holy, is something which is just so fundamental to what Yiddishkeit is all about. And as we probably know, the Rishonim take different positions as to how exactly to translate the mitzvah Kedoshim Tiyu. You should be holy. Rashi says that among other things, it means to be prushim in harayos, to separate oneself from immorality in a sexual sense. The Ramban very famously introduces this idea of a novel birshus haTorah, a person who technically speaking is following every law to the letter, but acts in a way which is degraded and disgusting. You know, a person who gets drunk every night and eats enormous amounts of food to the point of being nauseating. You know, he may be technically following all of the Torah's dictates, but certainly he's not acting in a way which, I guess, in very broad terms, we would describe as being menschlich. So the Ramban says Kedoshim Tiyu comes to address that kind of thing. The Rabbeinu B'chai has an interesting take of his own, which again he expressed just in a few lines at the beginning of Perek Yutes Pasuk Beis. Kedoshim Tiyu, ki kadosh ani Hashem Elokeichem, you should be holy, because I Hashem am holy. Al derech hapshat lashon kedusha, even precious vehevda. From a pshat perspective, kedusha, the word kedusha itself, refers to the idea of precious, of separation, and hevdel, differentiation. You know, making a distinction between yourself and others. So, what does that mean in our context? Ba parsha hazos azhara l'chol yisrael shu prushim u'gedurim b'midos sehem. So, what that means in context, this whole parsha exhorts Klal Yisrael that we should be separate and distinguished in our midos. That is, we should be distinguishable by the unique kind of midos which we have specifically. She is bonein kol echad ve'echad al yodov v'yo'ir aleihem. That everyone should be focused on the parents who brought that person, who brought him into the world, and should acknowledge them as being his parents. Shioid habein al aviv ve'imo shehem lo ke'en habore. That a son, a child, should see and acknowledge his parents and the role that they played in bringing him into this world. If you do that, if you acknowledge the parentage of your parents, so that makes you distinguished in your midos, and that in turn is what is meant by the kedusha of Kedoshim Tiyu. So you may say that's a very narrow way of defining Kedusha. Kedusha means I recognize who my parents are, right? And if I don't recognize who my parents are, if I don't pay special attention and give special care to my parents, you know, so that's not Kedusha. So he goes on to say as follows. V'yo'ir al avore shuha ova elyon yisparach shechide sholomo. And from recognizing the role that your earthly parents play in bringing you into the world, you're supposed to then go the next step and recognize your heavenly parent, the Ribbono Shel Olam, who created you and brought the world as a whole into existence. If you recognize your own parents, and through that, the creative quality of the Ribbono Shel Olam, the Hakaras HaTov that you have the Ribbono Shel Olam, that's called Kedusha. Now, Mimela says Rabbeinu B'chai, he goes on to explain, that's why the parasha opens up Kedoshim Tiyu Ki Kadosh Ani Hashem Elokeichem Ish Aviv V'Imal Tiro. It starts off with the mitzvah.
The parents are one third of the
right. But in other words, it's easier to acknowledge your flesh and blood parents than it is to acknowledge HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Is more, you know, we don't see him, we don't interact with him in quite as direct a way. But the parasha starts off with Mora of Vo'eh, with the sense of reverence that we're supposed to have for parents, because that helps define Kedusha. All midos tovos, he seems to be saying, stem from that awe and reverence that we have for parents, And ultimately, all of the awe and reverence that we have for HaKadosh Baruch Hu stems from the awe and reverence that we have for parents. So all of Kedusha goes back on some level to Mora of Va'im, to the reverence and awe that we're supposed to have for parents. Kedoshim Tiyu starts with Ish Imo Va'aviv Tiro. Well, let's put it this way. What Esav proves is that Kibbutz Av Va'Em won't automatically lead to all the other things, but it doesn't dispute the contention of Rabbeinu B'chaye that if you want to get to the other things, the first step is Kibbutz Av Va'Em. In other words, you know, you're not going to get to higher levels of Kedusha if you disrespect your parents. Right? Now, Esav respected his parents, and then he stopped there. You know, he didn't keep climbing the ladder. Okay, that's also possible. But in other words, for some, you know, if somebody presents themselves as a chassid, a tzaddik, you know, et cetera, and he doesn't have proper kibbutz av va'em, see, you know, something's wrong. I think that's the point Rabbeinu B'chaye is bringing out. That's the building block of everything.
You can't walk if you haven't learned to crawl. You
know? Right. The crawling is recognizing the Hakara Sato.
I was thinking that. I was wondering, of course, deal with also the forbidden relationships. When a person knows who his father and mother are, the Megillah, he knows his siblings, he can't marry them.
Right.
He knows there's that line of demarcation.
Right.
Right.
So 100%, there's an element of Kedusha, recognizing your parents, just, you know, not recognizing your parents in terms of giving them honor and respect, which is partially recognizing who they are, you know, because if you don't know who they are, so that makes the rest of the arayos, you know, tricky, which, again, I mean, we live, but unfortunately it's not as, you know, not as much as we think of, particularly, you know, in a society with adoptions and things like that. I mean, you know, you have all kinds of crazy situations that come up, but... Right.
On the positive side,
you know, right. But I think what the Rabbeinu B'chaye is bringing out is not just recognizing one's parents in terms of IDing them, but, you know, the whole idea of awe and reverence of parents, that's the building block of Kedusha. You know, you're not going to get to Kedusha unless you start with that basic midah of being makir tov to your parents and ultimately to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and then everything has to flow from there. If you're not going to start with that, it's not going to go anywhere. Right? Again, it brings to mind, we quoted this in the past, Shufa from Rav Maisha, where he was asked the question by a giyores, a certain giyores, after she was megayer, she cut off all contact with her mother. Right? She was afraid, you know, that her non-Jewish mother was going to influence her, was going to influence her children. Ultimately, she cut off all contact. And, you know, years passed, the non-Jewish mother was sick in the hospital, so the Giyaris wrote a shayla to Rav Moshe, is it proper for me, am I allowed, is it the right thing for me to do, to go and attend to my mother in what's probably her last illness, you know, or no, I should keep aloof. And Rav Moshe writes it back, he says, of course you should go and attend to your mother in her last illness, and he says the following lumbus. He says, we find that the Rambam writes that although a ger is not chayiv in kibbutz av va'em in the strict sense of the term, because again, from a strict halachic perspective, ger sheneskaya ketinuk shenol adami, they're not his parents halachically, right? So, you know, what are you going to talk about kibbutz av va'em? They're not his parents halachically. But again, that doesn't undermine the fact that biologically, they're certainly his parents. And that's the Rambam writes. A ger is not chayv in kibbutz av va'em in the fullest sense of the term, but a certain degree of kibbutz av va'em he should show. So where does that certain degree come from?
Like Kiddush Hashem, like if you go to visit a
goyim. Right, but it's even more than Kiddush Hashem. He says even more than that. So says Rav Moshe, where does the little bit of kibbutz av va'em come from? You have a lot of the mitzvah, you have a little of the mitzvah. What does it mean to have a little bit of the mitzvah? So he says, Hagam, that kibbutz av va'em is only a mitzvah which is incumbent upon Jews, as the Gemara makes clear, right? The famous stories of the Tava ben Nesina make it very clear that that only Jews are chayiv in kibbutz av va'em. Nonetheless, says Rav Moshe, there is a basic human trait of hakaras hatov, and hakaras hatov is incumbent upon everybody, Jewish or non-Jewish. And even a non-Jew they may be not chayvin kibud av va'em as a formal mitzvah, but even a non-Jew is expected to have a certain degree of hakaras hatov for the person or the people who brought him into this world. Right? It's not one of the shiva mitzvahs b'nei Noach per se, but there's an expectation of hakaras hatov. Moshe writes in the Tshuva. Right? So what's the difference between that? So why aren't they chayvin kibud av va'em? Because kibud av va'em demands of a Jew things that are extreme. You know, again, the famous stories, Tosfos brings in Kiddushin, you know, Reb Tarfon's mother lost, you know, her sandal broke, so Reb Tarfon got down on the floor, you know, he put his hands on the floor and she walked on his hands. Okay, so, you know, Al Sakara Satov, you can pass, right? In other words, if Reb Tarfon was not Jewish, there's no way he'd be expected to do all of that. That's an extreme. Now, the mitzvah of Kibbutz Avraham is mechayev him to do that. Now, this is very clear over there. You know, that wasn't considered to be, you know, super duper unusual. The Chachamim said to the mother of Reb Tarfon, you know, that, you know, he hasn't done half of what he owes you, even by putting his hands under her feet. Right? So Hakara Satov demands what we would consider to be normal behavior that indicates a certain degree of you know, recognizing the good that was done. Kibud av va'em demands an extreme degree of hakara satov. Right? So it demands an extreme degree of hakara satov. You know, but that's Rav Moshe's mechadish. The idea of hakara satov is so basic that it's incumbent upon non-Jews as well. It's not something which is unique to Jews. So that I think fits in nicely with this Rabbeinu B'chai. The midah of hakara satov, which is involved in mora of and kibud of, is so basic to kedusha that you know, that you're not going to get anywhere without that without starting with that midah.
So a quick question about the course of could we extrapolate from how would he have dealt with the fact that she was not keeping in touch with the flower? Is that okay?
No, I think he was opposed to that. In other words,
he was opposed to what?
To her breaking contact.
Oh.
Yeah, in other words, you know, she only asked the Shaila at the end of the story. I suspect had she asked the Shaila earlier on, he would have told don't break contact. I mean, obviously you have to, you know, be very, very careful to make gedorim, you know, so that, you know, that your children are not going to be influenced. You're not going to be influenced. Okay, but there are ways to do that. You know, it doesn't have to come with a total severance of all ties. Okay, so I don't want to go through the whole piece. I just wanted to bring out that idea. Kedusha starts with Hakara Satov. You know, I think that's, you know, a very, very powerful idea, which certainly is relevant for a pasha, which is called Kedosha.
What is the direct relationship? I understand that without Hakaras HaTov, you're not necessarily going to follow Kadosh Baruch Hu. What exactly is the relationship of Hakaras HaTov to Kedosha?
Right, so he starts off by saying Kedosha means that you're separate, you're different, right? In this, and I think what he means to say is that someone who's a Kadosh is distinctive, stands out in his midos tovos, and that's what defines you as a kadosh. In other words, if kadosh means separate, the question always is separate from what, right? So I think it means separate in the sense in which we just had the Haggadah, milamid shahayu Yisrael mitsuyanim sham, you know, Klal Yisrael and Mitzrayim stood out, right? They were noticeable. Right, so a person should be noticeable in terms of his midos. You should have midos that cause people to say, "Oh, yeah, you know, that's somebody who has really good midos." In that sense, you become a kadosh. You become set aside and parush. You know, not parush that you won't eat dessert. You know, parush in the sense that you're distinct. Right. In other words, you know, you're set aside, perhaps from a world that doesn't have those kind of midos. Right. You know, where midos hakara satov. You know, everybody stabs everybody else in the back. You know, so your midah of Hakara Satov is something which stands out. Okay, so that's really by way of introduction. I wanted to look at a prime example in this week's parsha of Rabbeinu Bechaye's bringing together many, many different ways of looking at a pasuk and looking at a mitzvah. Again, Rabbeinu Bechaye tells us, I'm going to analyze everything from the pshat, derash, kabbalah, philosophical, you name it, you know, I'm going to give you every angle. on the pasuk and on a particular mitzvah. Here, with regard to the mitzvah of Arla, which appears later on in the parasha, he really goes at the mitzvah from many, many different perspectives. So this is Perek Yates, Pasuk Chav Gimel. Shalosh Shanim Yuvalachem Areilim, for the first 3 years of the growth of a fruit of a tree. There's Halacha of Arla, right? So why? What is the basis for this Isser of Arla, that the first 3 years of the growth of the tree are going to be prohibited? So again, I think just it's a beautiful example. First, the Essam things that he's going to say are beautiful, but it's also a beautiful methodological example of how he just, you know, comes at an issue from many, many different perspectives. First of all, what does Arla mean? What is an Ariel? So Zafter, Lashon Arla, Lashon Kisuihu. Arla means a covering. A person who's an Ariel, in the sense that he's uncircumcised, it means that the top of the Aver HaZachrus is covered by the Arla, right? So how does that apply to the fruit? Why is the fruit covered? Ki'ilu ha'peres mechusim bi'ilanos. She'ilu reshus ligabuhem v'lo lehenos mehem. So he says, with the fruit, it's a little bit harder to understand. The fruit is not physically covered, but the fruit is halachically covered. Since the fruit is inaccessible for the first 3 years, it's as if there's a covering, you know, a do not touch sign, which is, yellow tape, which is all over the fruit of the first 3 years of the tree. Well,
touch?
I'm sorry?
Touch?
No, I didn't mean not to touch in the literal sense, but not to...
He does.
Yeah, but I don't think he means it in the literal sense either. It means not to eat, you know, not to be metapa with. Yeah. So why is there this Isser of Orla? So he lists off a whole different series of perspectives. Al derech ha-pshat, from a pshat perspective, and he goes on to quote the Ramban. He doesn't quote the Ramban by name, but he goes on pretty much to quote from the Ramban. Tama mitzvah lo seis kavala kodesh baruch hu mepi arishon hagamur hatov shebe'arseinu. The part of Arla is really a positive thing. Arla is expressed as a negative, but really the idea of Arla is a positive. The first viable fruit from the tree should be dedicated to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the first year of viable fruit, the first year of viable fruit, should be dedicated in some way to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Narvas, for the first 3 years, you don't have viable fruit. Everybody knows the first 3 years of fruit, shvacha fruit, it doesn't have any tam, it doesn't taste good, it doesn't have any good smell. So it's not worthy of being brought before HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so you can't bring it before Hashem. So you can't eat it either. Because remember, the first fruits belong to Hashem. And the first good fruit belongs to Hashem. So if the first 3 years are not good fruit, they can't go to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but you can't have it either. You have to wait for 4 years for the first real good fruit to appear on the tree. And the Ramban makes an interesting observation. The Pasuk says that man is like the tree of the field. Just as the tree doesn't really become the fruit of the tree is not really anything worth writing home about until the 4th year. So too, there's a certain level of maturity in man that doesn't really appear until after 3 years have finished. What's the example of this? Isha p'chusa v'ashal shanam yamechon keno saying etzba ba'ayin ba'ayin dami u'besulasel chosun. Right, the Gemara writes that Rachmana Litzlan, a girl under the age of 3 is violated, so it's not considered halachically to be a violation of her, because the dam besulim is not going to be permanently broken. That blood, those blood vessels, are going to regenerate. What does that mean? That means that there's a certain level of maturity once the girl goes into her 4th year, where things are real to a much greater extent, and the first 3 years of the girl's life, you know, some of the anatomical aspects of her body are not really fully developed. They're kind of like the fruit of the first 3 years.
I heard that some people say that the fact that
Right, so we'll actually see, he doesn't talk about upsharing, because I don't think it was a practice in Spain in the 1400s where he's writing. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so. But he is going to say something very similar, which is not quite upsharing, but we'll see. It could be very easily related to the idea of upsharing. We'll get there in a little bit.
Yeah.
From Arlo, yeah. I think it's a common correlation, but we'll see something that he does say, even though he doesn't talk about upsharing per se, but it fits very nicely. Again, we'll see it when we get it. I don't want to, don't want everyone picking up and leaving before the end of the shiur. I don't want to give away the ending, but we'll see it. I think you'll appreciate it when we get it. Good. So therefore, the mitzvah of Arlo comes along. Basically, it's not so much that there's an Isser Orla, it's that there's a mitzvah of Revoy, of bringing the fruit of the fourth year up to Yerushalayim and eating it in a state of Kedusha in order to dedicate the first viable fruit, the first good fruit to the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the first 3 years, you can't really do anything with them. You can't give them to Hashem, they're immature. You can't give them to people, because that would be favoring people over the Ribbono Shel Olam. So Mimela, there is an Isser of Arla which is generated. That's, he says, that's al derech hapshat. And again, without quoting the Ramban, but that's the explanation the Ramban gives. Al derech hamedrash, just skipping a little bit to the next to last line on the page in the Rabbi Shavel edition. Al derech hamedrash. And he quotes here from a Medrash Tanchuma, right here in Kedoshim. Shalosh shanim yiyu lachem areilim. Medaber betinok. The fruit of the tree is comparable to a child. She'eno yachol lahasiach ledaber adayin. For the first 3 years of life, the child can't really speak. Now, I assume what he means, again, for those of us who have interacted with children, three and under, they do speak, but he can't speak anything of substance. Right? Yeah, he can put together sentences, but there's nothing of substance that he's really talking about. Well, v'shana haraviyas kodesh, in the fourth year he's holy. Sha'aviv mekadsho la'Torah, his father sanctifies him by beginning to learn Torah with him in some way. Hilulin la'Hashem shumahalal HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the child praises HaKadosh Baruch Hu. V'vashana chamish is tochlu, in the fifth year, you eat the fruit. What does that mean in terms of the child? Shumaskel likrel batorah. He begins reading from the Chumash inside. So, in other words, the Medrash Tanchuma perceives the education of the child in this way. We know the famous Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says that ben Chumash lamikra. He's going to quote it in a minute, right? That the kids should start learning Tanakh, start learning Chumash at the age of 5. However, there's a kindergarten year. That's what the Medrash Tanchuma says. There's a year before the formal education begins. That's when the child goes into his fourth year, right? In other words, he's turned 3 and now has begun his fourth year. When he begins his fourth year, the father starts training him for Torah, which presumably means, even though he's not able to read inside the Chumash yet, he starts learning Aleph Beis, he starts learning certain Psukim, he starts learning certain concepts, Chumash readiness, that by the time he's going into his fifth year, and Ben Chumash Lamikra seems to mean the way Rabbi Bechai, or the way the Tanchum is interpreting it, Ben Chumash Lamikra means when he's 4, in other words, when he's going into his fifth year, right? At that point, that's when he begins. He should be able at that point already to learn Chumash, right? Again, it's not unreasonable that the kid can, in his fourth year, the year leading up to the point that he's 5, can already, begin to read a little bit. And mikan ho'elach lahosif lachem. The pasuk says lahosif lachem tvuasa, that from there on in, there'll just be more and more which is added. Mikan shanu razal is based on here that Chazal said, Ben Chamesh Shanim LaMikra, Ben Eser Shanim LaMishnah. Right? The idea of starting to learn Tanakh or Chumash at the age of 5 comes from the idea of Arla. Right? So this is what I mentioned before. So there's no correlation between between Upsharon and Arla, certainly based on this Medrash, But the idea which kind of goes along with Upsharon, the notion of the chinuch of the child being tied to the mitzvah of Orla, you know, that the kid turns 3 and he starts wearing a yarmulke and tzitzis, and that's the beginning, aleph beis, that idea is, you know, hinted at in some way
indirectly
in this Medrash Tanchuma. And again, we should point out that if you look again, look at the early Ashkenazi Rishonim who didn't have the minug of Upsharon, but did have a minug of a whole ceremony surrounding, you know, the Haskalah of Limud and all of that, you know, so that really does come from here, from this idea of the Medrash Tanchuma, that somehow the development of the pre is supposed to mimic in some way the educational development of the child, right? So you have that idea sort of in here.
Works the other way, meaning we're teaching the child, and at this time this is when the tree is ready, so they make the upshare.
Right. In other words, you could see how you would get from here to Upsharon. In other words, all you need is the next step to say, well, if the kid is like a pre, and you're not touching the pre for the first 3 years, so maybe we should not touch physically some aspect of the child for the first 3 years. But again, that's not what the Tanchuma is saying. But you know, it's not hard to see how you could get, you know, from one place to the other. In other words, you could see the connection. Fine. So that's al derech ha-medrash. What's that? Al derech ha-seichel. Just skipping down a few more lines. What about al derech ha-seichel? Derech ha-seichel in the terminology of Rabbeinu B'chai is a philosophical approach, you know, a Bar Nevuchim type approach, right? So he's outlined the pshat approach to Orla, you know, that it's a way of highlighting the fourth year. He's highlighted the midrashic approach to Orla, that it's a metaphor for the whole idea of the chinuch of the child. Why do we observe Arla from a philosophical perspective? So he says, "Hashamayim v'yaretz hem sibul lahotzah sapri b'koach elyon." How does fruit come about? Basically, fruits come about as a shidduch between the heavens and earth. The heavens provide the rain, the earth provides the ground, and lo and behold, you have the pri, right? And he says the relationship between heaven and earth is similar. It's similar to a male and a female. One is active, one is passive. We have the pasuk in Yeshaya, which we lay on Tanesim for the Haftarah, which describes the rain coming down from the heaven and giving birth, giving birth to the vegetation that grows from the ground. If you think about it, it's not that hard to imagine. The rain is the dugma of the zachar. The ground is the dugma of the nekeva. Chazal describe a woman who is violated against her will as karka olam, right? She's described as being like ground. You know, the zachar is giving into the nekeva, which is the ground. And what comes out? The pri, right? It really corresponds in a certain sense to human biology. For the first 3 years, the heavens and earth are not really interested in bringing forth this pre, because the pre that they bring forth is, again, as the Ramban said before, a low quality pre. So if you eat the pre of the first 3 years, you're, so to speak, saying that you're not interested in the desires of the heaven and earth. Heaven and earth, you know, it's practice up until the fourth year. You know, it's only in the fourth year that they're giving forth the pre that they really consider to be the true pre. So to eat from the pre before the fourth year is to disregard the desires of heaven and earth. And of course, who made heaven and earth? It's the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. So to eat from a fruit which is not totally ready is to say that I don't care about the Creator who said that we'd rather wait. What does that mean exactly? So let's just read it one more line, and then I'll try to give another mashal, which I think is what he's saying. V'hineu notlo below rishus shel ma'ilo v'shel mato. You're taking the pre without permission from above or from below. That's why the Torah says that within 3 years you can't eat it. what's he saying? So consider the following mashal, right? It takes, for argument's sake, it takes an hour and a half to properly bake a tray of chicken. You come home and you smell chicken, so you ask your wife or whoever's making the chicken, oh, I smell chicken in the oven, we're having chicken for dinner. Yeah, it'll be ready in another 45 minutes. Well, I don't want to wait the 45 minutes. Yeah, I'll eat it now. So it'll be it won't be fully cooked. Okay, no, I'm okay with that. I like my steaks raw. You know, I'm fine with that. No. It takes an hour and a half. It'll be ready in 45 minutes. You know, you have to. No, I'm going to eat it now. Right? In a certain sense, one can argue that if the one who's cooking the meal has in mind to bring the meal to fruition, and the meal, the chicken, the meat, is not going to be ready for another 45 minutes, for you to jump the gun and eat it prematurely shows a lack of respect to the cook. Right? I mean, would you ever go into a fancy restaurant and, you know, you order your supper, and they say, okay, you know, it's going to be cooked to perfection in 20 minutes. I don't want to eat. I don't want to wait to 20 minutes. Bring it out now. No self-respecting restaurant would ever serve you the food half cooked. Again, if they would, they would tell you that they would use some kind of French term for it, and then you pay even more money for the fact that they bring it out half cooked. But right. But no self-respecting cook would allow the food to go out half baked or half cooked. And adrab, it's a chutzpah for you to storm the kitchen and to take the stuff before it's ready. It shows a lack of respect for the one who's preparing it. So too, I think that's the mashal that he's saying over here. For you to take the fruit prematurely, the way the Ribbono Shel Olam made nature is that the fruit is only ready, you know, after 3 years have passed. So you're taking the fruit early, it's technically edible, you're right, but you're showing a lack of respect for the way the Ribbono Shel Olam made the world. You know, you're not willing to wait until the fruit is really at its peak, when it's supposed to be ready. So you're not respecting HaKadosh Baruch Hu made the world, and in fact maybe you're saying that HaKadosh Baruch Hu doesn't run the world. In other words, you know, it's not the cook who runs the kitchen. I run the kitchen. He just happens to be cooking in the kitchen. I determine when I'm going to eat the food. Right? I think that's the idea that he's bringing out over here.
Rabbi, yeah. You eat the fruit the fourth year, right?
Right. But in Yerushalayim.
Right. So if the first 3 years it's premature, it's not really that edible, and if you wait till 4 years for it to be edible, why not dedicate it to Hashem the fourth year and eat it the fifth year?
I think that's what you're doing. Meaning, what do you mean dedicated to Hashem? You're dedicated to Hashem by eating it in Yerushalayim. That's the sense in which you're dedicating it to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Right. So again, that's a philosophical perspective. As you said, al derech haseichel. Yeah. No. It's mamish. It's totally also about no. Yeah. Yeah. But by the way, you know, orla is one of the few agricultural dinim that applies in chutzal aretz as well. As there's halacha l'moshe mesinai that suffic orla in chutzal aretz, we don't have to worry about. But you know, if you plant the tree in your backyard and you know that it's Arla, so that applies even outside of Eretz Yisrael. Meaning, conceptually, it's not one of the mitzvos atlios ba'aretz. It's not like truma or maaser, you know, these things that are dependent on the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. This is some sort of basic, you know, that transcends our relationship to Eretz Yisrael, which again fits into all of these different things. This is about our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you know, it's not just about the Kedusha Sa'aretz, because we see that it applies in Chutz La'aretz as well. Yeah. Right, so in Chutz La'aretz, no. Right. In Eretz Yisrael, so there are all kinds of dinim in terms of its proximity to the trees, you know, but right, no, so he would have to do some investigation, right. You know, so he would not be able to assume just off the top of his head, well, it's probably okay. Yeah.
Marshall says, he did call Aretz, right?
Right. Okay, so Rabbeinu Moshe, Nosam B'mitzvos Tam B'Perek Shvi B'Sefer Amora, he goes on to quote the Mor Nevuchim. Rabbeinu Moshe over here is the Rambam. Ki Hayu La'Ovdei Avodah Zarah B'Smanim Hayim Min HaKishuv Shehayu Osim Be'Es Metiyas Vayilonos. The idolaters of ancient times used to have all kinds of incantations that they would make where they would plant trees. Fahayu Mezumen B'Yad Kol Echad Mehem Dover She Azura also Sham Bishas She Yisra also Sham Bishas Natiya Makom Ilan Osvivav Vaychosh She Ilan Memayr Lahot Sipur Yosam Yanoz B'Tivo Shalom. They had, you know, these magic powders that they would sprinkle, you know, when they planted the tree, thus thinking that they would invoke the powers of nature to make the tree, the fruit of the tree, grow even faster. So says the Rambam. So these of the Avodah Zarah think they're going to make the fruit go faster because of their Avodah Zarah. L'chach tziv sotar b'isra apri abo kodem shalashon shliyovov laso samaisim aroim ahem. You know what? You of the Avodah Zarah think you're going to make the fruit grow faster. I'm going to tell you, you can't have any fruit for the first 3 years. So in other words, there's no point in your, you know, engaging in these idolatrous practices, because anyway, for the first 3 years, you're not going to be able to eat the fruit. Now, l'chara, what he means is not that the fruit would grow faster, because then oil wouldn't help. Okay, good. So the fruit will go after 2 years as opposed to after 3 years. You'll still come out ahead. Apparently, there are, what they believed was that, you know, again, we said the fruit of the first 3 years is a shvacha fruit. They believed that by sprinkling this powder, they could make it a good quality fruit, even after a year or two. So comes the Torah and says, no, you can't eat it for the first 3 years. You can sprinkle whatever powders you want. It's not going to make a difference, you know. And this way, it discourages people from using their magic powders, you know, to try to improve the quality of the fruit. Ultimately, says the Rambam, like he does for many, many different mitzvahs, the Isser of Arla is an anti-Avodah Zarah Isser. You know, it's the Rambam says that in many, many contexts. Says that about Peyus. You know, that the ancient idolatrous priests used to cut their payas. That's why we can't cut our payas. You know, he says that about Basar B'chalav. You know, they used to have a fertility rite, and they would cook the kid in its mother's milk. Basically, the Rambam says, you know, so many of the mitzvahs that we do that are chukim are really anti Avodah Zarah. They're anti some Avodah Zarah practice which has gone out of vogue, which we don't know about anymore. So Arla is also an example thereof. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering,
if a guy
plants a tree, it's also
Arla,
meaning you
can
have...
No, Davka Jewish tree. Yeah.
Is it edible for 3 years? Is it really edible?
So apparently it's kind of edible. Meaning it's not of good quality, but, you know, I mean, like crab apples. Are crab apples edible? Kind of, you know.
Certainly it's not ideal.
Right. I mean, I guess if you wanted to, you know, leaving aside the Isser of Arla, it's edible if you want a desert island with nothing else to eat, but, yeah.
Well, even if it is edible, it's a chok. The Rebbe Shlomo gave us the halacha,
right.
That's it.
Right, okay, but, you know, so what's behind the chok? You know, so you see that he's giving a lot of different reasons for the chok.
But, if this Arla is a deterrent for practicing the Avodah Zarah, why have I have me that somebody practices Avodah Zarah is going to observe Arla?
Oh, so it's very, we don't appreciate this, but remember there was in the time of the Bayis Rishon there was a tremendous Yetzirah for Avodah Zarah. And as you see, going through the whole Tanakh, there were Jews who were scrupulous in every other thing, but somehow they couldn't resist the temptation for Avodah Zarah. However you want to explain that, but, you know, it's not a stira to imagine someone being careful about many other things, but, you know, somehow falling into the Isra of Avodah Zarah. Well, consider, you know, according to many interpretations, the Egel Azov, you know, I mean, that in its own right. The Jews are just barely, you know, left Matan Torah, and already they're involved in Avodah Zarah because it has such a magnetic pull on people.
A tree that doesn't give any fruit for, let's say, 5 years,
you don't have to give the first to...
No, so, you say, so the first...
Keep it for yourself?
Yeah, no, no, it's the first... Whenever the fruit starts growing, that's when it counts.
From
when starts growing, yeah.
No, that's,
no, 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 no. So whenever the first 3 years of fruit become arla.
Really?
Yeah.
What growth would be made on the fruit of the first 3 years of the Ganesha fruit? Is it the fruit enough to make it more pure, or isn't that the quality quite of the tree that therefore would be overlooked?
So I think, as far as I know, it would have to be on a case by case basis, but he wouldn't say automatically that the first 3 years is not considered to be a pre, to the point that it's not a bar pre ho'etz, you know. So in that respect, you know, maybe it's edible enough, you know, that meets that threshold. Yeah.
He says that
yeah.
It's dangerous.
Yeah.
For 3 years.
Yeah. So, I don't know, you know, right. I mean, I don't know that it's true across the board. I guess it depends on the fruit, you know, but certainly it's not of the best quality, that's for sure. Good. Okay, so that's the Rambam. That is the Rambam. And I'll read you what he says, finally, al derech ha-kabbalah. I can read it. I don't think I can explain it, but I'll read it. Al derech ha-kabbalah, mitzvos arla shechikat Torah hanatiya shalosh shonim keneged ha-shalosh ha-oyonos ha-rishonos. The first 3 years of fruit that we're not allowed to eat correspond to the first three spheros, which are beyond our comprehension. Keser, chachma, and bina. She'ein lanu behem ha-saga. Vashana haravias kenegba gamken ruach elokim rachefes al pnei amoyim. Right, the fourth year, which corresponds to the midah of gedula, is also something which is mostly beyond our comprehension. That corresponds to the idea of netar revoy that we bring to Yerushalayim and eat in a state of kedusha, but it's not totally to us. And it's only afterwards, only once we get to the fifth sphera, that we can really begin to understand on some level what we're talking about, so that the fruit becomes to us. In other words, the fruits are symbolic of the spheros and our lack of ability to relate to the spheros that are highest up on the rung of the spheros. Don't ask me anything more than that. But clearly that explanation, Alpi Kabbalah, is in a very different vein than, you know, the Rambam, the Ramban, the Medrash, the philosophical explanation. And the godless of Rabbeinu Bechaye is that he doesn't skip a beat. You know, you can look at it this way, you can look at it this way, you can look at it this way, you can look at it this way. It's malakit, everything. And they're all true. It's not that, you know, this is the right way, this is the wrong way. You know, this is all true. You know, all the shivim panim latara. You know, you have so many different ways of looking at this one mitzvah, and they're all correct. In other words, they all highlight a different aspect of the mitzvah, which helps us understand it. Okay, we'll see how much we have time for. I wanted to see briefly the next pasuk, lo sochlu al hadam, which, as we know, thou shalt not eat on the blood. It's a very strange expression. Chazal understand it in many, many different ways. So he quotes that Chazal say, lo sochlu al hadam, hu azharash lo yochal adam kodam tefila. Chazal explained this in one way, as saying that he shouldn't eat before davening in the morning. Lo sochlu kodem shetispalu al dimchem. Don't eat before you daven for your blood. In other words, we think we just come to davening in the morning because it's something you got to do. No, you're pleading for your life every single morning when you come to davening. And of course, it's not past that you should eat before you go and plead for your life. But davening in a whole different perspective. Along those lines, va'odar shubala sochel al adam, ashar l'dayanim shlo yudarim din nefasha sela baboker. Speaking of pleading for your life, this also teaches us that when the dayanim judge a person, they should do so in the morning. In other words, that the dayanim are not supposed to eat before they render a decision about what's going to be with this person's fate. Right? Because whenever you're rendering a decision or involved in rendering a decision or pleading a decision with regard to your fate or the fate of someone else, it's not appropriate to eat before that decision has been rendered. Right? It's an extension of the idea of not eating before davening. And then he goes on to make the following statement, which just is it takes facts which we know, but casts them in an entirely different perspective. That's why we fast on Yom Kippur. Why do we fast on Yom Kippur? So he says as follows. Right? On Yom Kippur, we're all being judged. Right? We're being judged throughout the day. Right? The judgment is taking place throughout the entirety of the day. You know, what's going to be with us? It's the final, the final countdown to the judgment. If you're going to eat, you're going to get caught up with eating. You won't be able to daven properly and to plead your case properly before the Ribbono Shel Olam. So if every morning you're not allowed to eat before you daven and plead your case, and if a judge is not allowed to eat before he renders judgment against someone else, certainly if you're spending the day in the last ditch effort to plead your own case, it certainly makes sense that you shouldn't eat as a result. You know, the whole day, until Ne'ilah, until Ne'ilah is over, until the day is done, you're busy pleading your case. So that's why you don't eat on Yom Kippur. Right? A very fascinating way of looking at it. By the way, we know there were certain Rishonim who held that it was appropriate to fast on Rosh Hashanah as well. We don't hold that way. Right? But there were those who fasted on Rosh Hashanah. The idea of fasting on Rosh Hashanah would fit in very nicely with this idea as well. I mean, Rosh Hashanah mamish is the Yom HaDin. Right? Yom Kippur is, in a sense, the appeal. Trying to, maybe undo what happened on the Yom HaDin. To get in a little bit of a change before the Chasima, before things are sealed. But the din itself takes place on Rosh Hashanah. So the idea of not eating on Rosh Hashanah, would make sense from his perspective as well.
That's why we hear, I think, with this halacha, you don't eat before the Tchias, no? It's such a halacha.
Well, that's true. I mean, I think usually we understand that that's because any mitzvah which you have, you're not supposed to eat before you do the mitzvah, if the mitzvah starts at the beginning of the day. But it does add a new, layer of understanding to it. If the tekiyas and mamash is part of the din, as the Ramban and Chumash writes, they are, that's part of the din. So certainly it's not appropriate to eat before the tekiyas. Okay. This is why we fast on Yom Kippur. The idea of fasting on Yom Kippur is tied to the idea of davening for the din. And for every day as well. That he's really quoting the Gemara. Lo tochlu kodesh tisfalu al dimchem. When you're davening for your blood, you're not allowed to eat first. But again, it gives a different perspective. On davening, it gives a different perspective on Yom Kippur as well. Okay, we'll pick up as Hashem next week, and wish everybody a good Shabbos.